If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider leaving a rating or review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps me out a lot. Cheers.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So I wrote the first 20,000 words, no idea what was really going on, other than like, here are lots of cool ideas. Put it aside for 4 months or so, and then came back to it and went, I will now sort of extrapolate an outline from the starting point.
Hello and welcome to the Novel Analyst Podcast. I'm Jed Hearn, and it's normally my job to analyze stories to help you become a better writer. But in today's episode, we've got something a little bit different, because I am interviewing Gareth Ryder-Hanrahan, who is a writer and game designer. Originally qualified as a computer programmer, he took a 3-month break to see how writing would go. More than 15 years later, he is still on that break. The writing thing seems to be going. He describes writing as the process of transforming tea and guilt into words, which we talk about in this upcoming interview, and his debut novel, The Gutter Prayer, was published by Orbit Books in 2019. The Gutter Prayer is about three young thieves caught in an ancient magical war between gods, monsters, ghouls, wormmen, tallowmen, and magicians. It's set in Girden, a city deep with secrets, sorcery, and subterfuge. And just a few days ago, I analysed The Gutter Prayer in a Novel Analyst episode. So if you haven't checked that out, I would highly recommend it. And it's really exciting for me to be able to not only do an episode diving deep into analysing a book, in this case, The Gutter Prayer, but also to have a chat with the author pretty much right after I've recorded that episode. So in today's interview, I get to have a nice long chat to Gareth about world building, about some of the books and writing advice that has inspired him, and how he goes about, in particular, writing his books and what he has learnt from writing various role-playing games, and how he has translated that into fantasy books. So, without further ado, here is the interview. Gareth, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
No worries. So, I want to start with The Gutter Prayer, because I read it only a couple of weeks ago, and out of the fantasy novels I've read this so far this year, it has had the best world building out of any of them. And I'm not just saying that because you're on the line. I said that in my Goodreads review I wrote of it as well. But I wanted to ask you about the world building. What is it that allowed you to execute such a fantastic setting in this book?
My day job, so to speak, is writing tabletop role-playing games. So I've done... Well, Gutter Prayer is my first original novel. It's by no means the first setting I've created, and I spent a lot of time playing in other people's settings as well, doing licensed games. So I have a lot of experience in basically creating playgrounds for characters to run around in and create sort of odd nooks and crannies of worlds that wouldn't necessarily crop up in a narrative but are still present in the fictive setting, which gives us a nice sense of like, I don't know, what's the line of Hitchhikers? Fjords add lovely Baroque feel to a continent. Similarly, like, you know, weird stuff to down alleyways adds a really Baroque feel to a novel.
Absolutely. Yeah, it definitely has like a very distinctive flavour or tone to it that is like quite, I suppose, unusual for fantasy novels that I've read so far. But yeah, I found that like really interesting. And is that something that you are like quite fascinated in exploring in your settings, that kind of distinctive Baroque tone?
At this point, it's more almost like more instinct than anything else that I like adding complexity and adding a sort of lived-in feel to narrative. I'm allergic to neatness, basically.
No, I love that. That's good.
As you can possibly see from the desk, but anyway. I'm always very suspicious, is possibly the word, of books where everything is very, very neat, where A leads to B leads to C leads to D, and you can, like, you know, you can see that the thing introduced, the one interesting thing introduced in chapter one, you know, is going to be the thing that, like, you know, pays off at the
sure.
end.
Yeah.
So if you introduce, like, you know, 16 different interesting things in chapter one, then you sort of ambush the reader.
That's a really good point. I guess if you, like, hide the tree amongst the forest, so to speak, then it becomes a lot more exciting because they have no idea how the foreshadowing is going to pay off. And yeah, that's definitely something that happens in the God of Prayer now that I think about it. Yeah, okay. That's a good technique. I'll have to steal that. Because, yeah, I think... Yes, sorry, you go.
The downside, obviously, is you can end up sort of, like, you know, massively confusing the reader by bombarding them with information. So everything's a trade-off.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because, like, when you look at all of the different monsters and creatures in the God of Prayer, from, like, the Tallow Men to the Crawling Ones to the Stone Men to, like, all of the other things that are in there, you could quite easily have written a whole novel just about, like, one or two of those things. But you combine them all into this kind of one epic book. And how do you decide, like, when too many ideas is too many? Or, like, when do you think it gets, I don't know, like, too packed, too crammed in? But then at the same time, how do you trade that off against having too few ideas in a book?
There are two related factors. There is ideas that overwhelm the setting and ideas that would overwhelm the reader. Deal with the reader first. You need sort of... any sort of, like, you know, transfer of information from, like, you know, author to reader, or game master to player, or, like, you know, narrator to audience, that has to be sort of mediated. You have to, like, you can't tell your audience everything at once, and you have to sort of, like, flag the important things they'll need to remember for the story. There's the whole, like, rule of three idea, where basically, like, whatever I tell you three times is important. So, like, you know, the Gullheads, for example, were this, like, really minor monster in the book. They're not important. They're just background data. You get told what they are, like, once, I think. They're mentioned, like, you know, two or three times. If you like, you are like me and have no memory of what you're reading, and you could forget about them and go, oh, there's a weird monster thingy over there. How the crawling ones work, with their basically, like, you know, worms that eat people's brains and, like, you know, sort of steal the knowledge of the dead, they're actually relevant to the plot later on. So they get, like, you know, there are, like, three or four times where someone says, but as you know, Bob, it's a bit more subtle than that. But
it is much more sophisticated than that, yes. Yes.
But there, at some point, it is mentioned several times that crawling ones eat the dead. Did you know the crawling ones eat the dead? Look, it's a dead-eating crawling one. So that, like, you put that into the reader's mind, go, okay, crawling ones, dead eaters, remember that. And then for the actual setting... there it's really just working out which monsters or which concepts can be sort of, like, you know, hand waved away as not massively affecting the rest of the setting, and so the ramifications of them existing doesn't overwhelm the rest of the story. Like, for example, in an earlier draft, there was another race of spellcasters called singers, who could do sorcery and so forth, and they were made by the alchemists. And they ended up being cut because their existence raised so many questions about, like, the nature of the setting and the nature of, like, what the alchemists could do, and the legality of Gwerdon because they'd been emancipated. It basically, the novel would have been about them. And I went to write. But my technique often is basically just, like, throwing ideas down and then working out where they go. Like, large chunks of the novel weren't outlined. So, for example, the singers just went, like, here's a crowd of odd creatures, I'll add these guys in. They hung around for a few drafts, and then they got cut out. So, yeah, you have to sort of, like, you know, track which bits will unbalance the world, so to speak.
That makes a lot of sense. So, like, is this one of the books that kind of, like, the setting came to you first, and then the characters and the plot were a, like, thing that closely followed, or was it in a different order?
What happened was I sat down, wrote the first 20,000 words or so, pretty much with no idea where I was going. I had bits of the setting in my head. I had vague ideas for one of the characters, Carolyn. And I had, like, you know, a wealth of experience dealing with, like, Lovecraftian stuff and weird monsters and so forth from gaming. So I wrote the first 20,000 words, had no idea what was really going on, other than, like, you know, oh, here are lots of cool ideas. Put it aside for 4 months or so, and then came back to it and went, ah, right, okay. I will now sort of extrapolate an outline from the starting point. It turned out to be a very good way to do it. I'm going to try it again with other novels, because it got me over the whole sort of, like, you know, fear of the blank page. I could just, like, write without worrying about where it was going. And then when I came back to it, it felt like sort of editing someone else's work, and I wasn't as, like, you know, as nervous about it. It gave me a nice sort of, like, you know, lump of wet clay to work with.
That makes a lot of sense. It's almost like, yeah, you kind of discovery wrote that initial 20,000 words and then, you know, kind of realized, oh, these are things that interest me about it, and these are things that, like, not so much. And that is a very good approach to, like, having it develop organically, but then also maybe bring in some more, like, outlining and structure sides of things in subsequent drafts. So has that approach been similar with the sequel to The God of Prayer? Or has that been more structured?
The sequel is a bit more structured, because the plot's a bit, not necessarily more complicated, but in the sequel, basically, there are three different factions, and you're basically seeing the plot from their three sides. Whereas with The God of Prayer, while the main characters were split up, they were all pretty much on the same side and were discovering the mystery at the same time. Whereas in this, each of them has, like, you know, bits of what's going on. So that required a bit more structure. I did a similar thing where I wrote, like, the first three chapters and then set it aside for a while and then came back, which didn't work as well that time, because there's a murder very early on in the book. And I think the identity of the murderer changed 11 times.
That's a little inconvenient.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, okay, who, okay. Or not the identity of who killed him, but the reasons for them doing it and the time at which it was revealed as to who did it and why and what was going on. And if I had, in retrospect, in any sense, I would have basically, like, you know, either cut that murder or nailed it down a lot earlier.
Sure.
Having this, like, you know, flailing arm of plot, like, you know, sort of, like, groping for an answer for a long time.
Yeah, well, I guess one explanation is you could just explain that away by saying there's, like, 11 parallel dimensions going on in the next book or something like that.
Oh, don't tempt me.
Yeah, I mean, the novel's, like, as complicated as it gets to start with, so I can't wait to see how it gets even harder from there. But that'll be quite interesting.
But still very accessible.
Still very accessible, yes, of course. Yes, you just need, like, an 11-sided dimension map to make your way through this complicated multiple murder plot. But speaking of maps, actually, we've touched upon this a bit, but you actually had your writing start doing gaming books and developing writing for games. So could you talk me through that? Because I didn't actually know that. I thought The God of Prayer was your kind of, like, first foray, and then did some research for this and found out that, no, in fact, you've actually had quite a lot of experience with writing before foraying into this book.
Yeah, I mean, I started out basically with doing Dungeons & Dragons, that sort of games, as hobbies, and then accidentally blundered into doing it as a career when the company I was doing IT stuff, and the company I was working for shut down. I said, oh, well, I'll try freelancing for a while until I run out of money, and despite the nature of freelancing, haven't run out of money yet.
That's awesome.
I know, so quite surprised. I've been doing gaming books for nearly 20 years at this point, which is a horrifying thing to say. And there's a lot of the skills do transfer right over to fiction. Other instincts that it's covered, not so much. But world building is certainly one of them. In both cases, you're creating this, like, you know, this setting for the characters to run around in. You need dangers. You need various factions they can get involved in. You need a sense of history, a sense of place. These are interesting baroque nooks and crannies. You need some kind of conflicts they can glom onto. You need different backgrounds that make for interesting characters, different social pressures. I mean, all that jumps right across the novel building, novel writing.
Yeah. And I think at that aspect of, now that I think about it, having kind of those multiple red herrings present in your plots to kind of throw readers off a bit, like, I can totally see how that would come across from writing game books, where you want to give, you know, the players multiple options as to where they go in that plot. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's one reason why I actually need to do outlining, because I'm so used to writing plots that where you can have, like, you know, 11 different reasons for that guy to murder the person, because depending on which option the players pick, one of those might make more sense than other ones. Like, you know, if I was writing a murder mystery in a game, then I'd want to have, like, multiple ways for the character to investigate that, to discover who did the murder. So I might need to, like, you know, tweak, like, where they find the murder weapon, so, like, you know, wherever they go, they will find the bad guy's diary. So things have to be sort of, like, multivariant and multidimensional there. But with a novel, you have to lock things down much more solidly, which is why I need to outline myself to sort of, like, you know, the guy, like, you're lashing himself at the wheel of the ship, so he can't steer it.
What else have you found, like, easy to transfer across and hard to transfer across?
Easy, just doing descriptions, or the information handling I spoke about earlier. Because in a tabletop game, you're even more constrained, because when you're writing it, you need to transfer information to the game's master in a very efficient fashion. And, you know, the game's master is going to have to deal with a bunch of players who aren't sitting there reading. They're, like, you know, they're chatting at a table, they're playing with their phones, they're talking about the last episode of Game of Thrones. So you need to basically know what information is important and know how to convey it in a sort of arresting and interesting fashion. My big weakness, I think, is the characterization of the protagonists, because I'm so used to writing things where the players will come along with their protagonists and slot them in. So I'm fine with doing background characters, and protagonists are still a bugbear, but it's getting easier.
Yeah, absolutely. So what has allowed you to kind of, like, I guess, make such a sustained career in writing for, like, as you said, 20 years, am I correct in saying that?
20 years. Exaggerating slightly, but I started freelancing in 99, I think. But then full-time since 2003, so, yeah, getting close. Do you want the sort of the practical writing approach or the creative approach?
I guess both. Like, I was just curious as to see, like, what do you think it is about you that has allowed you to be, you know, as you say, like, successful in writing, freelancing career over such a long period of time?
I mean, I had several advantages and privileges. I kept bills down. I, you know, ended up inheriting a house, which, like, you know, really, really helps with rent. The Irish tax system is quite forgiving to writers. There's the thing called the artist exemption, where if you are a accredited artiste, you're exempt from a large chunk of income tax.
Oh, that's amazing. So, I wish we had that in Australia. That's so cool.
It's really good. I can recommend it. Although you do have to prove you're an artist by sending submissions to a man in the tax office who knows what art is. From a creative side of things, I've always said, you know, if you're relying on writing as your day job, then, like, you know, having to eat is a great spur to creativity. Also, just like reading widely in like non-fiction fields, and, like, you know, just absorbing stuff from everywhere. Like, I mean, if I look back, one of the most influential books I've ever read for me was this book on Victorian engineering called Seven Wonders of the Victorian Age. It's basically about, like, you know, these seven, like, you know, impressive things the Victorians did, like the Great Eastern Steamship and this Bell Rock Lighthouse, which basically stole almost word for word from Guerdon, and, like, you know, the sewers of London and so forth. And that just, like, you know, gave me sort of, like, you know, seven, I'm going back to the information handling stuff again, seven neat self-contained slices of, like, you know, major problems that were solved with, like, century-old technology in different parts of the world for different reasons by different people. It was just, like, you know, a thing that I could sort of chop up, digest, and regurgitate is the wrong word, but like, you know, repurpose in several different fictional bits. Because I mean, you take any of those, like, you know, you take the Sewers of London, you add magic, and you've got like six different novels there. You've got Neverwhere, you've got the Ghouls of Garden, you've got setting where basically the characters are cleaners in these, like, you know, these pipes of this divine engine, which basically creates the universes, and like they're out there cleaning up the, like, you know, the discarded shells of previous universes and fighting monsters or whatever. Where you take any real world thing, twist it and add fantasy, and you've got like the bones of a novel there.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, I'll have to check that out. So that's the Seven Wonders of the Victorian Age.
Yeah, I think that's the title.
Great.
Victorian Industrial Age. It was a BBC series, like, you know, again, many, many years ago.
So you've spoken about that book. What are some other books, apart from the obvious references to, like, Tolkien and, you know, the other kind of main figures within the fantasy world? What are some other books or authors that have particularly influenced you or that you really respect and that have influenced your writing in some way?
Let me think. In terms of just sort of style guides, the sort of writing book I always recommend is Jeff Vandermeer's Wonder Book, which is a fantastic resource and it's basically targeted at like fantasy writers and like your speculative fiction writers, and it's a wonderfully friendly and sort of permissive approach to writing. Like, there's one fantastic essay in there by Kim Stanley Robinson, who did the Mars series, where he basically says, like, you know, I love info dumping. I like chapters where characters stand there and tell you interesting things. Because if you've picked up a book about Mars, you're probably the sort of person who wants to know about, like, you know, the composition of the Martian atmosphere, how it can be changed. And rather than, like, you know, sort of laboriously chopping it up and putting it into a conversation or something, or, like, you know, like trying to disguise the fact you're info dumping, just so the character goes, right, here's an essay on the Martian atmosphere. I find it fascinating. I think you'll find it fascinating too. And that enthusiasm sort of carries over. What else? I'm a huge fan of Umberto Eco's Foucault's Pendulum.
Okay.
Which is a real novel for grown-ups. even though it is entirely about secret societies and the wackiness of occult history. And it's hilariously and fantastically written. House of Leaves, which has slipped a bit from sort of the cultural consciousness, but was huge for a few years. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not familiar with that, no.
House of Leaves is... it's this book about this house where weird stuff starts happening, sort of haunted house effectively. But the book is presented as this manuscript that was found by another character who then footnotes it. And the formatting gets incredibly bizarre. They're like, you know, sections where like the text are spiraled around the page, or they're like, you know, pages upon pages of internal footnotes, or bizarre bits where the footnotes interact with the main text, even though they were like in the fiction supposedly written later, and also like hidden messages and codes. It is wonderfully pretentious. And borderline unreadable, certainly at the first time through it, but it's a wonderful sort of fictive experience. It's like, I mean, one thing I love from gaming books is doing handouts where you basically, you know, do up a fake document or something and hand it to the players, and they like actually read it in the real world and have to like decode it. And House of Leaves is sort of the narrative equivalent of that, where you're basically handed this artifact and you have to make sense of it.
That sounds like a fantastically mind-bending novel. I'm definitely going to check that out. Okay, that's really cool.
I mean, I'm trying to go up there. It's like, you know, you can, if you sort of x-ray the Gutter Prayer, you can sort of see all of those lurking in there. Any other massive instances? Not really. If we're not going through like the greats of the fantasy genre, like Gibson or Lovecraft or, again, Jeff Vandermeer, who was a huge influence, or China Meevil, who I really can't at all deny either, with Weird Cities. They'll be the ones that spring to mind immediately, but it is like morning here and I've only had one cup of tea, so.
Sure.
I'm sure.
I'll put the links to all those in the show notes so people who are listening can check those out. And
yeah, And I'll also, like, you know, think of them like an hour later and go, oh, wait.
Yeah, please do, by all means. Yeah, because, like, it's, yeah, it'd be really interesting just to see how, like, if there's any things in there that have created, you know, clear influences in the Gutter Prayer and have kind of, you know, bled into your own writing in positive ways. Because, yeah, I don't think it's a case of stealing necessary. I think it's a case of just being inspired by the greats that have come before and then stealing all of their best ideas in the end, but you don't call it stealing.
Well, yeah, you're familiar with the Tom Lehrer song, are you?
No, I'm not too sure.
Tom Lehrer's song, Plagiarize. Let no one else's work plagiarize. Plagiarize, plagiarize. only be sure, please, to always call it please. Research.
I love that. Okay. You're giving me a lot of stuff to check out here. This is good.
Oh, yeah. If I've introduced you to the music of Tom Lehrer, then my morning is made.
Okay, right. That's really interesting. It's fascinating to me how closely writers seem to associate with some musicians, because, like, I've interviewed authors before, and they are, like, diehard fans of, you know, a particular artist, and then you go listen to some of their music, and you can totally see where it kind of bleeds through into their own writing. Do you have anyone that's sort of like that for you? Or is this just an oddity that I've observed?
No, I mean, I can certainly associate, like, parts of the Gutter Prayer with different artists. Like, I listen to a lot of V&V Nation while listening to the Gutter Prayer, or writing the Gutter Prayer. Actually, a lot of podcasts as well, especially the second book. The second book was written basically to a background of national security podcasts.
Oh, wow. How do you focus while there's, like, people talking and you're trying to write?
Poorly.
Fair enough.
I mean, it depends on what I'm writing at the time. But my theory, though, on artists and music, though, is that, like, writing is, by its nature, a sort of, like, you know, a lonely profession. You are going to end up sitting in your room at your keyboard with no one around, headphones on, for hours at end. So, like, the musicians of the podcast become your friends. They talk to you.
They talk to you. I love it. That's good. Sounds like you're entering some of those 11 dimensions yourself. I love this.
Exactly. they're the people you've had, like, you know, the longest conversation with of the day.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's true. If you're doing, how long do your writing sessions normally go for?
It depends. Cause I have, like, three kids, so things get interrupted. I normally work in, like, you know, sort of 4-hour chunks if I can. Anything other than that, and I tend to just sort of, like, be babbling or just, like, you know, writing, like, you know, one word every 10 minutes while I'll tap into Twitter. Actually, it's another book I would heartily recommend is Deep Work. It's a sort of, like, productivity book on, like, the virtues of concentration and focus and so forth. It's basically 500 pages of You Should Get Off Twitter.
That's by Cal Newport, right?
That's the one, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I've been meaning to read it for ages. Okay, this is definitely going to push me over the line. So yeah, what has been useful from that?
Yeah, there's another book, which is a more practical version, but Deep Work is kind of more inspiring because it talks about, like, you know, how wonderful creativity is. But yeah, I mean, the simple thesis of that is we're all far too distracted these days, and you can only do, like, great work if you are focused and eliminate distractions. So lots of signs up around the office saying, like, you know, turn off the internet, close the doors, put phones away. And some days I will be good and do that, and those are good days when I get lots of words done.
Fair enough. And on those days when, like, it is difficult to maybe motivate yourself to write, like, is there anything in particular that you kind of use to get out of those slumps, or, like, any, I don't know, words you say to yourself, or just, I don't know, general practices to help you get out of demotivated periods?
Looping back, I mean, again, because writing is my day job in various forms, then if, like, you know, I know that if I fall behind too much, it will have, like, a severe impact on paychecks and career, so sure. That really helps. More practically, having multiple projects on the go at once. So if I'm, like, you know, totally stuck on one thing, I can switch to something else in a very different field. So, like, you know, at the moment, I'm working on the third Black Iron Legacy book.
Nice.
The sequel to the sequel. But I'm also doing... what else is going on? I'm doing a licensed thing based on Lord of the Rings.
Okay, I definitely want to talk about that more. That sounds amazing.
I'm doing a adventure for Knights of Occasions, which is the Spies versus Vampire game set in the modern day. And I'm supposed to be doing background fiction for a board game. And they're all basically different tasks of different, like, different lengths, different focuses, very different genres. And they're all the projects are at different stages of development. So if I'm stuck on one thing, then I can switch to one of those for like an hour or two and get some focus back. But ultimately, guilt is also the strongest motivator.
Yes, I saw that in your biography. What was it that you defined writing as? It was the process of turning... No, that's it. Writing by virtue of the alchemical transmutation of tea and guilt into words. I love that.
Exactly that, which defines my career at this point.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you mentioned you're working on the third Gutter Prayer... not Gutter Prayer, third Black Iron Legacy novel at the moment. How have you kind of structured... Like, don't give too much away, obviously, because only the first book is out and everything. But, like, what do you think has been useful for you to consider in terms of writing a series or just kind of structuring a multi-book arc?
In some ways the constraint was the lack of constraint, because like it wasn't sold as a trilogy or anything, and it was a two book deal with the possibility of more depending on sales. So I'm not sure how long the series will go for, so I'm trying to basically write each one as semi self-contained, and that a reader could theoretically pick one up and go, right, I can see that there is this, like, you know, deep background here, but all the bits of the background that I need for to understand the current plot will be in the current book. So my vague thought has been sort of treating it kind of like a TV series or something, where you have your sort of setting Bible and you're like, you know, your defined parts of the setting, but then each individual episode, even though they're only got like, you know, five of them at most, let's say, sets up its own internal plot, internal conflicts that build on stuff that came before, but aren't, you don't need to know read what came before to get the current thing. And then the truth there is also building towards an overall climax that'll make sense. And I think I have an idea on how to do that, but that's getting into majorly spoiler territory.
Yes, twin spoiler. Yeah. How has your writing changed perhaps since having the first book come out? Because that came out in, was it January of this year?
That came out in January, yeah.
Yeah. So how is, like, I guess the writing process or how you decide between choosing projects changed since having this novel come out?
Well, the novel was an odd experience for me, because with freelancing, normally you're given an assignment. You're like told, like, you know, we want X words on this thing, or we want a book on this topic. Or you pitch them a couple of ideas and they pick one. But it's normally like, you know, a supplement for particular games. So, like, you know, if we have a game, we have the license to do Lord of the Rings books. Like, you know, what bits of Lord of the Rings would you like to expand on? With this, it was like, you know, sort of when you're writing a novel for yourself initially, you've got this completely blank slate. So that was somewhat terrifying. And so I wrote the novel on spec, not like without a contract, and then went off and tried to sell it and get an agent and do all the normal writer things. And that was, from my perspective, sort of hugely self-indulgent, because like it takes away from work time. So now it's now that I actually have the contract, it's gotten easier, because I can sort of slot it into work time and turn down other freelancing stuff in favor of writing, while still trying to like strike a balance between the two, because... No, one of the defining qualities of a life freelancer is nothing is guaranteed, so you never want to. You have to. One of the great skills for freelancers is saying no to offers, but knowing which ones to say no to, because you don't want to close off options. You don't want, like, you know, to piss off clients, while at the same time you don't want to piss off existing clients by, like, you know, missing deadlines. So at the meantime, my main issue at the moment is just sort of picking which projects to do and making sure that whatever I choose to do won't impact on delivery of the next novel, which is priority number one.
Fair enough. Because yes, the sequel to The God of Prayer comes out in only a couple of months, right?
Sequel to The Shadow Saints is in January, and then the next one should be out in January 2021.
Nice. That's exciting.
Again, the guilt and the tea.
Yeah, exactly. Just need more tea and more guilt, and then more books will come out. What has been the best writing advice that you've ever received?
Finish the book. It's really cliche, but I mean, I wrote many, many partial novels back in the day. And by partial, I mean, like, you know, the first like three chapters, or like, you know, the opening scene and a page of notes. And then I would abandon it because I had, like, you know, quote-unquote real work to do. And if I hadn't been pushed to actually finish off The God of Prayer, I would still be writing, like, you know, those, like, you know, partial fragments of novels and then getting back to writing game material, which for pay, because, you know, once you... I'm in an odd situation, I know, because, like, you know, my day job is also, like, you know, making up stuff about elves, and then write novels is making up stuff about elves. And I'm sure Shakespeare would have, like, you know, put it slightly better, but that's true.
I love it. That's good.
And when one branch of elf making up gives you money on the spot, and the other is much more speculative, it's hard to sort of force yourself to sit down and finish it. And similarly, like, you know, I'm sure normal people, like, you know, watch TV and, like, you know, have social lives. And I hear those are fun too.
Not as fun as just pumping out book after book.
Yeah, well, you have to sort of sit down and go, right, you know, I will invest in this thing. I will get it to the end. It cannot be sold, or cannot be improved, cannot be edited, cannot be fixed until it is done.
Absolutely.
So sit down and finish it.
Yeah, I think there's a Neil Gaiman quote that goes like, anything you do can be fixed apart from a blank page. And that's something that, yeah, I definitely subscribe to. And I think it's, yeah, like you say, it's a cliche, but like, it doesn't mean that it's always followed by people. And I think it's still valuable to say it because of that.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, you know, the whole concept of, like, you know, information transfer, what, like, you have to be told a thing several times for it to sink in. Like, I mean, with writing books, I read, I read a good few of them, and like you only pick up, like, you know, one or two, like, you know, sort of like almost like, you know, bullet points of advice from each one. But if that's the advice that works for you and you sort of finally, like, you know, integrate it into your brain and sticks, then it's actually useful. You have to learn a thing lots before you actually know it.
Yeah, I totally agree with you because, yeah, I've read, like, quite a lot of writing advice books, and there's definitely, for most of them, that, like you say, you can probably boil down what you've learned to maybe six sentences, but even if only one or two of those sentences are going to give you what you need to produce a good story, then it's well worthwhile. Yeah. Do you have any other, like...
The books that I think, or the advice that you pick out from a book won't necessarily be the advice that someone else picks out from a book. It's a thing that works for you, and it's finding those things that it's hard, but it's also very, very rewarding once you actually finally find your sort of process and your groove to writing.
Apart from Jeff Vandermeer's Wonder Book, are there any other writing advice books that you found particularly useful?
M. Harold Page did this book, which I'll send you the actual title. I can't recall it offhand. I think it's like a storyteller's guide to thought or something, which I found very useful because it was basically about taking techniques from gaming and applying them to novels. Like, you know, like, you know,
I wonder where you've done that before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But again, I had to be told to go, oh, hang on, I have all of these skills I can drag over. I didn't study writing in college. I did computer science. I've no, like, formal training in writing. So I had, in the back of my mind, I had this sort of, like, you know, sort of, not shame, but sort of, like, you know, thinking, like, oh, like, you know, real writers know how to plot books that they've been taught. I'm not sure what I'm doing here. And then I was almost given permission by this book to go, hang on, you have all this knowledge of plotting from gaming, that can be applied in certain contexts in fiction writing as well. And while that's completely obvious in retrospect, I needed to be told by like an external authority. Yeah. So that's a good one. Trying to think of other useful ones that have really paid off, but Wonder Book sort of head and shoulders above everything else. My friend Robin Laws has a series of books on called Hamlet's Hit Points, about basically plot beats, which are... It's very interesting because Robin is someone I know very well, and like, I've written books based on his stuff, but we have very, very different approaches to writing, so it's sort of interesting to sort of like wander around someone else's head and sort of see how they think. And that was very useful, certainly, when editing the second book, to sort of like, you know, to be able to concentrate on plot beats and emotional arcs, which don't come naturally to me.
Sure. Is that because you're more like of an organic writer rather than someone who outlines things?
Partly, but also, I would think far more about the sort of the external plot and the setting as opposed to the internal lives of the characters. The main editorial note always get back is like, you know, well, how does this make them feel? And they're going, I don't know. They're just being stabbed. They're probably upset.
I would love for one of your characters to just be like, after their arm gets cut off or something, someone asks them, how are you feeling? And they go, oh, I'm just a little bit upset at the moment. Yeah. Some tea will fix it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Slightly peeved about this.
Peeved is such a great word to just absolutely convey zero levels of harm. It's fantastic.
Exactly, indeed. The cannon roared, he was peeved.
Oh, I love that. That's so good. So, speaking of like writing advice, what writing advice would you give to your younger self? So young Gareth starting his, you know, gaming writing career, like what would you give him that would help you maybe, I don't know, avoid any potential mistakes or just, you know, write, get to the place where you wanted to in terms of writing a bit faster or anything along those lines?
I think be braver. I mean, in a lot of ways, professional writing, I like, you know, sort of getting novels or whatever, is as much a matter of luck than anything else. I was really lucky that I found an agent very, very quickly, got a deal quite quickly once I actually sort of started doing it. And I mean, I can sort of self-justify that to a degree by saying, oh, like, you know, it took me like many years to hone my craft and blah, 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 blah. But really, if I had like written a novel like 20 years ago, there's a smaller chance it would have gotten picked up, but it would still be a non-zero chance. You sort of have to, like, you know, to buy the lottery ticket and take a shot. I think you sort of sit down, write something, put it out there, and see what happens. No one is going to sort of go like, you know, right, yes, you are now ready to write the novel. That's one sort of bit of external permission that you will never get.
Sure.
Although people can tell it to you, and it's something you have to internalize. So yeah, I mean, I would sort of charge ahead, be bold, and try more.
Great.
It's good advice for life, I think. Yeah.
Carpe diem. Great. Love a bit of Latin quotes in the interviews. Always spice it up a bit. So yeah, like that kind of leads to my next question, which is, I will come out and say 100% selfish question. I have my first book coming out tomorrow, so probably a bit late to ask you about this. Yeah, I got it here. Here's the thing. But yeah, I just wanted to ask you, like, what marketing strategies or I guess promotional things have you done on your end that have been really successful with The Gutter Prayer? And like what activities, you know, have been particularly good at moving that needle in terms of, you know, getting people finding out at the book and getting them to buy it and that sort of thing?
It's very hard to tell because you do something like send out arcs, you like, you know, chat to reviewers and so forth. And it's hard to sort of see the needle. It's hard to, like, you know, detect, like, you know, did Action X actually push stuff, or was it just a waste of time? I think my best advice is just sort of like, you know, be yourself, like, you know, do what you do, only more so. To a degree, it's all a crapshoot. Like, you these days, what matters is word of mouth, and you know, you're going to get more sales from like some random mention on Reddit or whatever that goes viral. Then like, you know, sort of, you know, carefully cultivate a bit of marketing you can do yourself. So again, all you can really do is basically sort of push it out there, keep pushing it out there, and hopefully something will catch fire. Like, one of my greatest regrets, there's a piece of an example of what a role playing game is, which I wrote for one book. And it's a jokey thing about, like, this, like, you know, orc is this orc who wants to, like, do sort of, like, you know, a social reform of a dungeon. And it's basically, it's like a quarter page example of, like, you know, how a role playing game works.
Sure.
And that has been screenshotted and shared across, like, Twitter and Facebook, like, millions of times. But there's no attribution. It's like, you know, it is from this book by Gareth Hanrahan.
Oh, no.
So, every few weeks, that'll, like, cross up against my feet again. I'll be, like, shared somewhere else.
And you'll be like, I did that, guys! And they'll be like, yeah, sure, Gareth, I don't see your name on it, yeah.
Exactly. And if the screenshot was, like, you know, 1 inch lower, they would have my name at the bottom.
Oh, no. Oh, that's so unfortunate.
But, yeah, I mean, you have no control over this weird environment we're living in, where we're sort of, like, you know, swimming through some informational soup, as opposed to having it, like, sort of, like, you know, pour. It's a weird metaphor, but I'll go with it. Like, you know, once you have these, like, sort of these waterfalls, the media, where you had, like, you know, newspapers, like, you know, publicists and so forth, and now it's just this soup, and you throw things into the soup, and you hope they float by it.
Sure. That's probably one of the best analogies I've heard for describing, yeah, about how many bits of information are floating around in social media. That's
Yeah, exactly.
That's really good. So I've got a couple of quick rapid-fire questions before we wrap this up. So get your rapid-fire face on. What is the most magical writing experience you've ever had? So you mentioned in your kind of author interview in the back of the Gutter Prayer that there was this scene where you, you know, just wrote it in one sitting and it was just like someone else had written it apart from you. What are some other similar writing experiences you've had that have just felt, you know, like there was something else writing through you, or just were, you know, sublime?
In my writing, or in other people's writing, or both?
In your writing, yeah.
Something. There was one of the projects I did was the Dracula Dossier, which is a game which is basically a rewrite of Dracula, where basically we. How it works is that Dracula is a novel. It's the after-action report of this attempt by British intelligence to recruit a vampire in 1894. And basically how the game works is the players get the text of Dracula as a handout at the start of the game, and it's annotated. But we also added loads of bits into Dracula. So basically we added in the characters that Stoker took out, and they're all involved in this plot and are busy doing stuff that was then cut out of the novel by British intelligence to disguise their operations. So I remember adding in, we added in stuff into Dracula, and we also had to change the timeline to make sync it up with earthquakes for various reasons. There was this whole thing with Dracula and earthquakes in the original novel that Stoker took out that we put back in. So we had to move the novel's timeline to match up with real world earthquakes in Romania. And I worked out that the night that Lucy Western gets killed by Dracula in the novel, because of our movement of timelines and everything, was now that going to be on like Friday the 13th or something. I was wondering, like, sort of synchronicity, where, like, you know, lots of things lined up. and it all or some of the like your sort of super significant feat, like your religious feast day, which fit perfectly with the rest of the novel. And that was just a lovely moment of like, you know, working with this existing text, adding stuff in, and it paying off in a wonderfully resonant way.
Yeah, very serendipitous for sure, just like that.
Exactly, yeah.
Such a great coincidence. What is the... We've touched upon some things that may be this answer, but I'll ask it anyway. What is the biggest mistake you've made as a writer, and what did you learn from it?
Ooh. I think what
just made no mistakes.
Yeah. Save often is a huge one. I think just like don't abandon a piece just because it isn't perfect on the spot. Your initial ideas, no matter how good they feel at the time, will require refinement and adjustment. It can take a few pages to find a character's voice or the right style. And I have so many abandoned novels that parts of which I could be salvaged, or if I stuck with them, they could have been a lot better, as opposed to going, no, this isn't perfect. I've picked up this violin and I can't play it instantly. Therefore, I will smash it on the ground.
Very sensible choice.
Pretty much, yeah. Very mature attitude, I think, towards the creative process. This thing I just started is not perfect. Discard it.
Ah, burn it, yes. Absolutely.
Exactly, yeah. The other piece of advice is, like, save everything. Like, I have, like, you know, files going back to, like, the start of my freelancing on my computer, which can, like, you know... Because, like, often, I actually have very few ideas, but I can rework the few ideas I have an awful lot and sort of disguise them a bit. And sometimes going back to, like, you know, your original, like, you know, the first time you put a thing down can be interesting, both because you get the sort of the freshness of the idea again, but also you can sort of see how much your craft has improved, how much your writing style has improved with practice. So you get both sort of the initial, oh, like, that's why I love that idea, but also, I was shite back then. Look how great I am. Now I'm allowed to tackle that idea properly.
Fantastic. So let's imagine that someone's just read The Garter Prayer and they've loved it. What are the three words that you would love them to describe the book as?
Other than buy next book, which is three words.
Hey, perfect. Sorry, I think you meant buy all books.
Buy all, yeah, indeed. Or buy more books. It could be stalling for time. I would say immersive. Bizarre and interesting.
I think that's definitely a good capture of what makes a book good.
Yeah.
Great. So we're going to wrap up in a minute, but before we go, what are you... You've touched upon this a bit. What are you working on at the moment, and can you tell us a little bit about the next Garter... Well, the sequel to The Garter Prayer that's coming out in a few months.
Right. Work at the moment, as I said, I'm doing Errantry of the King, which is a adventure for the One Ring role-playing game, where basically you're hanging around... Or it's a campaign, actually. It's set in the years when Aragorn was in disguise serving in Gondor, so it's about, like, you know, 30 years before the actual War of the Ring. So you've got, like, you know, Denethor as this, like, sort of arrogant young prince, not yet steward of Gondor. You've got Sauron is back in Mordor, and the armies of the Darkness are forming, but not yet attacking, and you guys are running around Gondor in its, like, you know, not in its heyday, but, like, you know, in a sort of somewhat less militant version of Gondor. And after that, I must get back to the long-delayed Moria adventures, where basically you're playing the dwarves who are playing Balin's colony, who are going, like, you're trying to retake Moria. I'm finishing off this epic adventure for the Fall of Delta Green game, where basically you're playing spies in the 1960s versus the Cthulhu mythos. And we have this long campaign where you're basically following the heroin trade from the Far East to Marseille, and it's like, you know, Lovecraftian take on the French Connection.
Nice. That sounds amazing.
It's been a research heavy experience.
That sounds like a very diplomatic way of phrasing it, but that's cool.
There was a lot of reading. Do you want to know about the French student riots in 1968?
That's my answer.
There was something in the water in 1968, definitely.
I love it.
And in our case, it's probably Shoggoths. What else? And yeah, I'm also working on book three of the Black Iron Legacy. Book two, which comes out first, and this is the weird sort of thing about like publishing industry, where, like, you know, you've read book one, which from my perspective is this, like, you know, thing that happened like several years ago.
Sure.
Book two is, like, you know, hasn't reached reviewers yet, but it's all done dust as far as I'm concerned in terms of, like, you know, my involvement with the production side of it. And book three is the thing that's, like, sort of, like, you know, in my brain. So I'm worried about giving spoilers for book three or book two. So book two is set about a year after the Gutter Prayer. The main viewpoint character is Elodora, Carolyn's cousin. And the sort of the initial plot is that they're gearing up for an election, the first election after the crisis that was described in the Gutter Prayer, where the city was radically changed and all the various factions that are trying to cope with the fact that, A, this is, like, you know, giant new city exploded in the middle of a garden, and B, the war is coming closer and closer. And you've got different factions trying to basically take advantage of the chaos and push things this way and that. And it brings in a lot more of the wider world. While it's still all set in the one city, you've got, like, different factions from overseas trying to manipulate events and infiltrate spies and so forth. And yeah, it's, like I said, there are three different perspectives, which are basically like taking three different high-speed trains and putting them all heading towards the same point. And the last half of the book is basically the very messy car crash that involves, or not car crash, train crash. And yeah, other than that, it's just, I don't know, raising children and, like, you know, trying to stay sane in the current environment.
Fair enough. All right, well, Gareth, thank you so much for doing this interview. I can't believe that's, like, been a whole hour. That really flew by. But yeah, thank you so much for your time, and really appreciate it.
Oh, that was lovely. Thank you so much. And good luck with the launch.
Thank you very much.
And that was our interview. Again, big thanks to Gareth for coming on the show today. I really enjoyed being able to chat with him. Like I said at the start of the interview, The Gutter Prayer has probably had the best world building in any book that I've read so far this year, out of the 34-ish books I've read so far. So if you haven't read it, I would highly recommend checking it out. And if you are hungry for another good fantasy read, my debut fantasy novella, Fires of the Dead, comes out tomorrow. So I am very excited. I don't think it is set in yet that this is my first book and that it's going to be out in the world tomorrow, but I'm very pumped. And if you are not familiar with Fires of the Dead, here is a quick blurb. Wisp is a pyromancer, a magician who draws energy from fires to make his own flames. He's also a criminal, one job away from retirement, and it can't come bloody soon enough. Leading his misfit crew, Wisp ventures into a charred and barren forest to find a relic that could change the realm forever. But they aren't the only ones on the hunt, and the forest isn't as barren as it seems. A jaded gang leader longing for retirement, a bloodthirsty magician with a lust for power, a brutish fighter who's smarter than he looks, a young thief desperate to prove herself, a cowardly navigator with secrets that won't stay buried. Together, they must survive fights, fires, and folk tales that prove disturbingly real, if they don't kill each other first. Fires of the Dead is a dark fantasy novella with a unique magic system, and if you enjoy books like The Gutter Prayer by Gareth Hanrahan, you will really enjoy this book, and like I said, it comes out tomorrow, so it would mean a lot to me if you would consider checking that out, and I am so excited and I cannot wait to share it with the world. So that has been our episode. I hope that you have taken a few nuggets of writing wisdom from this interview. I know in particular that I will be checking out a bunch of the books that we discussed today. And thank you so much for listening. Now go and write extraordinary stories. See you next time.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.